Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudevi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaura Gopinath Swami Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navadvipa Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaura Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Vrtale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve. Gauravani Pachane. Nivase Susanivadi Paskachade Satani. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutapad Kamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Cha. Sri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya. Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shah Panch Kapa Chibhasta Kibhasam Bhagavan Tapti Kinam Pavane Vyavashu 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 Vyavashu. Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jaya Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. August 5th, 2018 in Zagreb, Croatia, reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila. Chapter 7, Lord Chaitanya in Five Features, Text 46. Tapana Mishir Gare Viksha Nirvana. Sanya Shira Sange Nahi Mani Nirantrana. Tapana Mishir. Tapana Mishir. Gare, in the house. Bhiksha, accepting food. Nirvahana, regularly executed. Sanyashira, with other Mayavadi sannyasis. Sangha, in company with them. Nahi, never. Mane, accepted. Nirmantrana, invitation. Prabhupada's translation and purport. As a matter of principle, Lord Chaitanya regularly accepted his food at the house of Tapana Mishra. He never mixed with other sannyasis, nor did he accept invitations from them. Purport. This exemplary behavior of Lord Chaitanya definitely proves that a Vaishnava sannyasi cannot accept invitations from Mayavadi sannyasis or intimately mix with them. Tapana Mishra Gare Bhiksha Nirvahana Sanyashira Sange Nahi Mane Nirmantrana. So Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita Karna Guna Sangasya that we develop according to our association with the modes of nature. And the same is true in bhakti. We develop because of our association with devotees. Satam Prasanga Mamavirya Sambhado Bhavanti Urikayana Rasayana Kata. One can analyze, last night we were analyzing the progress of bhakti from Shraddha to Prema, and in terms of 12th chapter 8 through 10, and in terms of nectar of instruction, text 8 purport on the stages of meditation. But the advancement in Krishna consciousness can also be ascertained through degrees and kinds of association with devotees. Practically everything we are, everything we do, everything we think, has to do with our association, with something. We're always under some energy, right? We're either under, like Mahatmanastumam Partha Diving Prakriti Mashrita, we're under the spiritual energy or under the material energy. We're marginal beings. We're not able to just have our own opinions and our own tastes and our own activities completely independently of any other energy. We're very dependent beings. And we can choose whether we want to be under a spiritual influence or under a material influence. And then within those, we can also choose. We can choose, do I want to be influenced by the mode of ignorance, by the mode of passion, by the mode of goodness? And we can choose, do I want to be influenced by Brahman mentality, Paramatma mentality, or Bhagavan mentality? And we can choose, do I want to be influenced by Kunta, by Ayodhya, by Dwarka, by Mathura, by Vrindavan? And in Vrindavan, we can also choose, according to our taste, what relationship we want to have with Krishna. And even then, among the cowherd boys, there are different groups of cowherd boys. Among the gopis, there are different groups. Among the cows. So we have our own environment that is going to nourish us the most, according to our eternal personality. But if we have in our association something foreign to us, we'll also get influenced by that. And we find this is true even in just from the very gross platform. Like my father asked Srila Prabhupada in 1974, why are you so eager to distribute your food to people, even if they don't know anything about your philosophy? And Prabhupada laughed and he said, do you believe in infection? And my father said, yes. And Prabhupada said, just like you can get sick from eating the food of an infected person, if you eat what Krishna has eaten, you will get infected with Krishna's disease. So we do pick up the mentality, the desires, the point of view of the people, the things, the food, everything with which we associate with. Therefore, Krishna goes as at length in the Bhagavad Gita of all the different ways in which the modes of material nature manifest. Right? There's the modes of nature in food, the modes of nature in charity, the modes of nature in religious performance, the modes of nature in understanding, in knowledge, right? In so many different areas. And he doesn't even give everything. He's just giving a little sample. So what happens is, if you say, I want to be in the mode of goodness, but you listen to things in the mode of passion, you watch things in the mode of passion, you're friends with people in the mode of passion, you'll stop becoming influenced by the mode of passion. And you won't be able to exhibit the mode of goodness. So we're all in this situation where we're somewhat fragile. We're part of God. In one sense, we have the same powers as God, although to a minute degree. But the difference between us and God is we are subject to our association. We're subject to our environment. Krishna is not. Krishna is always Krishna, no matter what environment he's in and who he's with and what he's doing. But we're in a different situation. Like Srila Prabhupada said, that he was always praying not to fall into Maya. He said, I don't fall into Maya because I'm always praying to be protected from Maya. You know, doctors don't get sick generally because they take precautions, not because they're intrinsically a different kind of being. You know, they wash their hands carefully, they wear a mask. If it's somebody has a contagious disease, they wear a hazmat suit. I remember when I was a child, I don't remember the name of the film at all. I remember it was a black and white film, so I have some idea of how old it was. But I remember watching a film about doctors and nurses treating patients with some sort of very contagious disease. And there were so many patients, they were really tired, they were really stressed. And one of the nurses, without thinking, drank from a cup that had been used by one of the sick patients. And right after she drank, oh no! Now what have I done? Now what have I done? I don't remember what happened in the movie at all. But that scene really struck in my mind. Right? And this kind of thing happens nowadays with people treating patients who are very contagious or who have blood-borne diseases. You know, there was some time ago there was a talk of Ebola, which was a highly contagious disease. And sometimes the nurses and doctors treating the patients would become sick if they just, you know, some needle pricked through their glove or something like that. So this fact is true even on a very gross level. that we tend to become affected by our environment and our association. And it's certainly true on a subtle level, and it's even true ultimately on a spiritual level. Therefore, the admonition is there, even on the higher stages of bhakti, that one should keep company primarily with people who have the same mentality. I think I mentioned this the other day, that Jamuna and Dina Tarani were at one point just living, just the two of them, on their own. Eventually they joined the community in Sharanagati many years later in Canada. And of course, for a while they lived in Washington, D.C. But there was a time they were living completely on their own. And many devotees were complaining about them to Srila Prabhupada. Oh, they're not associating with the devotees. And Prabhupada wrote to them that he was happy with what they were doing. It was kind of interesting. And Prabhupada wrote to them, if two people are compatible, that is enough association. And if you're with 200 who are incompatible, nobody will make any advancement. So this principle of choosing our association, that doesn't mean that we can't interact in the world. That's not what it means. It's not that, you know, we should lock ourselves in a room and only have certain association and not talk to anyone else. But it means in terms of intimacy. So intimate loving relationships are described as six by Rupa Goswami. Dadi Pratyanati Guyam that's the next word. Anyway, so he talks about three, sorry, I can't remember the whole verse. He talks really about three areas, and in each area there's a giving and taking. So what are the three areas? Well, food, which in our case is prasadam. So food and gifts and
revealing
one's mind, speaking comfort, guyam. Not just ordinary talk. You know, you can not just, how do I get to the nearest petrol station? Or, do we need to get this paper ready for work tomorrow? But to really reveal one's mind and heart. So guyam, private things. So these are three areas in which we develop loving relationships. By sharing food, giving and receiving food, giving and receiving gifts, and giving and receiving confidentiality and talks. So these things should be reserved for people of who are like-minded. They should be reserved for people who are like-minded. Of course, Prabhupada talks about how we are giving prasadam to the public. We are giving the greatest gift of the holy name. We are giving the confidential knowledge of the Vedas to the public. But even then, we need to have some discretion. If we go to the public and say, I'm giving you food that's been offered to the deity, so many of them may not take it. Many of them will say, oh, it's some religious food, and they won't be interested. When we give people the holy name, we're enjoined, don't say so much the glories of the holy name to people who don't have faith. And although we describe the confidential discussions of the Shastra, we give people the Shastra, we don't talk to the general public about Rasleela and Radha Krishna's intimate affairs. We wouldn't even talk about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's advanced states of ecstasy just to the general public. So even then, we're careful. We're always careful about the audience. Who am I dealing with? And let me deal appropriately. And in the same way, we're careful what we take in. I find it interesting that pretty much all the religious and spiritual, genuine traditions of the world have some sort of restrictions on food. Of course, Paul threw out the restrictions on food when he was trying to preach Christianity to people who were not Jewish. He said, oh, you don't have to follow any of the Jewish rules about food. He said, it's not what you eat that pollutes you, it's only what you speak. And Prabhupada really criticized this. He said, so can you eat your mother? Can you eat stool? You know, how do you say that what you eat doesn't pollute you? In fact, everybody knows, just biologically, that what we eat has a big effect, not only on our physical health, but on our mental health. This is commonly understood in medical science. Yes? I mean, a big part of medicine is diet. It's a huge part of medicine, that what you eat affects you, again, not only physiologically, but psychologically. Everybody knows this. This is not a secret. So the fact that what we eat also affects us spiritually. So we're just going to look for the rest of this time, particularly on food, because, well, actually it's both. We could look at guhyam and food, not gifts. Because here it's saying that Lord Chaitanya didn't regularly meet with the Mayavadis or eat with them. So in other words, he didn't exchange confidential talks with them, nor did he accept invitations for meals. It's not get the item of gifts is not mentioned. So let's first talk about food. So food has both a gross and a subtle component. This is true of all food. I was in a temple once where the cook was a very violent man, actually physically violent. So he had been banned, this was in America, he had been banned from maybe 10 temples for violence. And the temple where we were in, he had been banned there 4 previous times for violence. But it was one of these temples where the leadership was changing all the time, like paper towels, you know, you always had new leaders in the temple. And so when we had got some new leaders, they said, oh, you know, let's give this man another chance. So I was on the management board at the time, and I said, absolutely do not give this man another chance. Forget it. And, you know, I got overruled. Anyway, so he was working in the kitchen. And again, of course, and he said, we'll give him one more chance, and if he's violent again, we'll throw him out. But they didn't. So, I mean, He would be working in the kitchen and he would threaten the other cooks with a knife, and I mean it was really extreme. He punched one of the other cooks in the eye so that the man's eyeball turned black and blue, and a few years later he died of a heart attack. But anyway, at that time he was one of the main cooks, which and the whole temple was affected by this. So it was a temple where people were regularly getting into arguments and sometimes even physical fights. That it was quite common for the devotees there to get into arguments. Even in the middle of Mangalarti, all of a sudden there'd be some big argument, seriously, going on. And a few of us brought up to the management, there's really a problem with having this violent person cooking. It's not a good idea. We were not taken seriously. But it does affect you, the mentality in which somebody cooks. There's you may know that most of the main governments of the world do experiments with paranormal phenomena, which they hope to militarize. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. They like to say they're not, but they are. There was a time that this was being done very openly, and in the former Soviet Union, they were very open about their experimenting with paranormal activity and paranormal behavior. So there were a number of books published by scientists who'd work with the government. Same with America. It used to be quite common, especially in Duke University. It was an open department to study paranormal phenomena. So one of the things that were studied was called Kirillin photography. And it's a kind of photography using electricity where they would try to photograph the aura or the effulgence around things. Very interesting experiments. They would take a leaf and photograph the leaf with this process, and you could see all around the leaf there was this light. And then they would cut the leaf in half, take a photograph of half the leaf, and you could still see a light pattern on the part of the leaf that was missing. That like the leaf had some kind of subtle memory of that part of the leaf. They would take photographs of people who did healings with their hands, you know, yogis and like that, and when the person was healing somebody, their hands would be like 3 or 4 times as bright as normal. So it was a very interesting thing. And they also took photographs of food. So they had photographs of food that was cooked at home, you know, like by the mother for her family, and food that was cooked in a restaurant. And the food that was cooked at home, the aura was two or three times brighter than that cooked in a restaurant. And some of the other things I found interesting was when an angry person would touch the food, the aura would decrease. So it wasn't just who cooked the food, but who handled the food. And would actually change the subtle effect of the food. So when people are eating this food from factories with all these preservatives and chemicals, and it's not only that such food is affecting them on a gross level, but the subtle mentality of the people in the factories and the shops is also affecting those people who eat the food. You know, we notice that when we grow our own food in our own gardens and harvest it fresh, it has a completely different taste. So part of that is due to the fact that it's organic and local. But you know, part of it is due to the fact that you're picking it from your own garden and other people are not handling it. It does really matter. There's both gross and subtle laws in this universe. Then beyond that, there's, of course, prasadam. So Lord Chaitanya was eating some prasadam and he said, "What is the taste of this prasadam?" He said, "We all know what are the ingredients that's gone into it, but the taste is beyond the ingredients." And there's a story I tell all the time because it's such a dramatic story. I was in Puerto Rico and I was in the morning I was cooking the main meal for the devotees, which I did like 3-4 times a week. And also in the kitchen was another devotee, Kamagiri Devi Dasi, and she was making cookies, which maybe you call biscuits, I don't know, if you use the American or the British term. And I watched her make them. They were very, very simple. It was butter, sugar, sodium bicarbonate, and flour. Perhaps she put some vanilla. That was all. They were the most simple, basic. You can't make cookies with more of a basic recipe than that. So we had a preaching event at the university and we brought the cookies with us. So it was maybe 120 people there, and after my talk, I was answering questions. People had come up to the table and they were asking me questions. And during that time, they were distributing these cookies. So because I was answering questions, I didn't get a chance to taste the cookies. But at least 40 people, students and professors, came up to me and said, "What is in those cookies? Please give me the recipe for those cookies." And I was thinking, if I gave you the recipe, you would be very disappointed. I had a similar experience with my sister-in-law. When we would visit her, I would cook. And she wrote me one time and she said, "Urmila, I have taken your recipe you gave me for making rice." It was just a plain, simple rice. She said, "And no matter how many times I make it, it never tastes the way you make it." So we experience this with prasadam, isn't it? You know, that there's some taste in the prasadam that cannot be attributed to the ingredients. I mean, like there's a taste from the tomatoes you pick from your yard that's different from you buy it at the organic food market. And that's different from you buy it at the grocery store. And then even more different when you offer it to Krishna. There is a difference. And we become affected. Prabhupada would say that he was watching the devotees feed some ducks in the river. And he said, "Oh, these ducks will get immediately a human form in a good family from this prasadam." They said, "Prabhupada, we feed the ducks every day." He said, "Then they will go back to Godhead." So just eating prasadam elevates us. And in the same way, if we eat food that's touched or cooked or prepared by people who are envious, lusty, greedy, angry, we become affected. It is said that if we eat grains cooked by non-devotees, our minds become wicked. And we may think, "Oh, this is just silly." But it's not just silly. It's real. I mean, I know of at least one devotee. who's very, very strict renunciate, and she only eats the deity's mahaprasadam and her own cooking. Prabhupada even talks about some brahmanas who are so strict they will only eat their own cooking. He said some of them will not even eat their wife's cooking, they'll only eat their cooking. So this, the problem is that even though we may accept this principle, following it is a great austerity. Even if you live in a temple, in most of our temples now, we're very sorry to say this, but in most of our temples now, we no longer have very strict standards about who cooks the food that's served to the devotees. I mean, when Prabhupada was here, we always had only one kitchen. Everything was offered to the deities, and everything was cooked on the fire by second-initiated devotees, and everything we bought was fresh. We did not buy canned things, we did not buy frozen things at all. We did not use oil, we only used ghee. I mean, we ourselves were very poor. Nobody had their own car, nobody had a bed. You know, we just slept on a mat on the floor. But we used ghee and all fresh ingredients, only Brahmin-initiated cooks, and everything was offered to the deities. And this was true even like, I remember in the New York temple, the old one in Brooklyn, not the current Brooklyn temple, we would make laglus. Not Tirupati laglus, ISKCON laglus. That means it had dried fruit in it. It had things like dates and figs and apricots and nuts, walnuts and almonds. Those are all extremely expensive ingredients. And we would make trays of laglus that we would then package and distribute without cost to the public. Although, I can't even imagine how much it must have cost. Of course, we did that as part of book distribution. So we'd give them a laglu and then we would sell them the book. But now in many ISKCON temples, and most actually, there's a deity kitchen and a devotee kitchen. So what's being served to the devotees is often never offered to the deities, and it's often being cooked by people who are not initiated and who knows what they're doing. In many of these devotee kitchens, the devotees are wearing their outside shoes, they're not having clean clothes, they're not following the principles, they're not chanting 16 rounds. What I find really sadly funny is that in many of these kitchens, they're offering the bhoga to a photograph of the deities. So they say, well, we can't offer this to the deities because it's not cooked by Brahmins and we're using canned tomatoes and we're not, you know, using all the second, third class ingredients. But we'll offer it to a picture of the deities. And I'm thinking, the picture of the deities is somehow a different deity that... can never get the logic of this. You know, what's like the Shastric basis for this and what's the logic for this? Or somehow, or, you know, I have a different form of Krishna here. So I have a form of Krishna here that's going to eat this and then we have a form of Krishna that won't eat it. It's kind of odd way of thinking. I'm not quite sure where it came from. I don't know of any source from Prabhupada or the scriptures or even just logic. Reminds me of one time I saw devotees who were cooking for their guru. And before they brought it to the food to their guru, they offered the food to a picture of their guru. And I said, what are you doing? And they said, well, our guru doesn't want us to bring him bhoga. He wants to bring us to bring him prasadam. So first we offer it to a picture of him, and then we bring it to him. Again, I thought, this is a very strange way of behaving. It didn't seem very, very rational. So anyway, this is what's happened in many temples. So the devotee prasadam is often not made with healthy ingredients. It's made often with very, very cheap oil and you know, really 10th class ingredients. It's not cooked by cooks who are strictly following the atmosphere. The kitchen is dirty. It's not offered to the deities. And so, first of all, everyone is affected by this. Everybody eating this prasadam is affected by this fact. And also, it doesn't give the chance for the devotees to worship the deities. One of the ways we worship the deities is by eating the deities' prasadam. And Prabhupada would say, you know, the whole idea of anyone coming to the temple is they're getting the prasadam from the deities. So this is what's happened generally. And in most of our temples where we have only one kitchen because of physical restrictions where they can't afford to have two kitchens, then generally there's just a low standard in altogether. So when I've been in kitchens where, you know, one kitchen is everything offered to the deities, they say, well, we don't have enough Brahmin cooks and so forth. So this is a problem even when you're in an ISKCON temple. If you want to say, well, I want to be careful about what I eat, and I want to be careful it's cooked by in a first-class way, by first-class people, and offered to the deities, you're going to go hungry in most ISKCON temples. I mean, I was in one ISKCON temple where on Lord Nityananda's appearance day, at the feast, they were serving this French bread. And that was a time when I was still naively innocent about the world. And so I just ate the prasadam. And maybe a week later, when we were coming back from Harinam, we stopped at a non-devotee bakery, and one devotee said, oh, I need to buy some bread. And they bought exactly the same bread. And I was sitting in the van, and I said, what are you going to do with this? And she said, we're going to use it for the Sunday feast. I said, was this the bread that was used for Lord Nityananda's appearance day? And she said, yes. And after that, I started becoming suspicious. Even at ISKCON temples and ISKCON-sponsored programs, you know, and I've been at ISKCON-sponsored programs where everything has been store purchased. You know, everything. You look at the cake and you say, wow, you've got a really talented devotee here to make that cake. Oh, no, no, we bought it. Oh. Even, I have to say, I was at the GBC meeting when I was the facilitator for the Devotee Care Committee, and that was the agreement was that if I would agree to facilitate the Devotee Care Committee, I could eat GBC prasadam for 10 days. So I said, okay, that's a deal. So when I went for breakfast, there was cornflakes. You know what cornflakes are? Mm-hmm. It's like packaged cereal. So I got really heavy with the devotees in charge of the prasadam, and I said, you can't serve this to the devotees. It's grains cooked by karmis. Please get it out of here. So somehow or other, he listened to me, which is unusual. People don't usually listen to me. I don't always even listen to myself. Anyway, so somehow or other, he listened to me, and he removed the cornflakes. Then the next morning, they were back. And I said, why are they back? He said, some of the GBC members asked for them. And I thought, oh my God. I was visiting, when I was in Mumbai years ago, I stayed at the home of this one devotee, Janaba, one of the leading preachers there. And for breakfast, she brought me cornflakes and bread. Now, generally in India, if you get bread, the devotees didn't usually make it. They don't generally know how to make bread. So I said, did you make this? I mean, the cornflakes, did she make it? It was pretty unlikely. I said, did you make this? And she said, no, I bought it from a shop. I said, no, thank you. And then she brought out the bread, and I said, who made this? Oh, I bought it from a shop. I said, no, thank you. So after 2-3 days of this, she said, you don't eat outside food, do you? And I said, well, very rarely. She said, you're the first traveling preacher who's come through here who doesn't eat outside food. And I thought, I mean, I do sometimes. Sometimes if I'm visiting family and there's some non-devotees and they want to go to a vegetarian restaurant, or probably once or twice a year. But I was very surprised. I was really very surprised. I was like, really? That's not the standard anymore. And then if you're a householder living outside, especially if both the husband and wife works or you're a single parent, eating only food cooked by devotees is really an austerity. It's very difficult if you have to do all of your own cooking. I mean, if there's a devotee restaurant, that helps. But if you live far from the temple, if you live far from a restaurant, and you have to cook everything yourself, it's quite a tapasya. You know, already to be vegetarian in a meat-eating society, I mean, it's getting a little easier because more and more people are becoming vegetarian and vegan, so I mean, like where my son lives in Southern California, there's so many vegan restaurants. So, but even that is not so easy. We're basically in a meat-eating society. And then on top of that, to eat things without onions and garlic. You know, so many vegetarian things you can get have onions and garlic. So already that's so difficult. And then on top of all of that, if you've got to eat food cooked by devotees, oh my God. What?
And by Brahman.
And only by a Brahman. You know, it's like, forget it. We're all going to starve. Right? Now, I remember saying this one time in a class, what I just said. And there was some sannyasi present. And the next day, he gave class, and he was saying, this is nonsense. It's not an austerity at all. It's so easy to eat prasadam cooked by devotees. And afterwards, I went up to him, I said, Maharaj, wherever you go, somebody cooks for you. So for you, it's easy. But for most people, it's actually very, very difficult. It's a huge austerity. I would say it's one of the biggest austerities that we have. And what I've seen is that the vast majority of devotees do not follow this. It's very, very, very rare for me to find devotees who are strict on this point. You know, and like I say, even you're visiting ISKCON temples. Now, even you're visiting ISKCON temples. I mean, frankly, sometimes in some temples, I'm very happy that they think, oh, you're a Prabhupada disciple, we'll give you the Mahaprasadam. I feel some guilt about it, that I'm eating nicer than the other devotees, but I think, oh, at least I know what I'm eating. At least I know cooked it. At least it's offered to the deities. So I know this is a very touchy point, and we seem to have, in the name of practicality, in the name of expediency, really compromised on this point. And there may be some circumstances where, I mean, Prabhupada saying here, never, you know, Mahaprabhu never ate at the home of a Mayavadi sannyasi. But Srila Prabhupada would sometimes eat at the homes of life members, and sometimes there were at least one or two times when Prabhupada was in a situation where people served him onions, and he didn't make a scene about it. You know, he didn't make sometimes Prabhupada would make a big scene about things, especially if people were blaspheming Krishna. Other times he wouldn't. And in fact, Srila Prabhupada writes that sometimes for preaching purposes, we have to eat in a hotel. In India, hotel and restaurant mean the same thing. So, you know, Prabhupada wasn't absolutely 100% fanatic on this point. He wasn't. There were times when, especially when he was traveling and preaching, that he would eat from food vendors because that was all that was available, and sometimes at life members' house. But as a general rule, Prabhupada was very particular about who was cooking for the deities. He would often, where he was traveling, ask to get some of the prasadam, to check the prasadam. Jamuna said that he could tell how many days previously the wheat had been ground by the taste of the chapatis. You know, Prabhupada wanted us to fresh grind our own spices and fresh grind our own wheat, which you may say is very difficult, but at least if you're cooking for, say, 20, 30 people, it's not difficult. If you're cooking for 200 people, that would be, grinding your own wheat would be a little cumbersome. But 20, 30 people, I mean, it isn't that hard if you have a good grinder. So Prabhupada would be able to tell this kind of thing just by tasting the prasadam. So I'm not saying that we should become fanatic about this, because number one, I don't think it's possible in 2018. And number two, Srila Prabhupada wasn't absolutely 100% fanatical on this himself. But I do think it would be wise to consider that what I'm eating is affecting me. Then the other is who we hang out with. So Lord Chaitanya not only wouldn't eat the food cooked by the sannyasi, by the Mayavadi sannyasis, but he wouldn't be intimate friends with them. So who do we have as our intimate friends? I mean, we can be pleasant and we can be friendly with everybody. In fact, we should be friendly with everybody. We should be kind to everybody. I mean, if somebody's trying to kill us, perhaps not. But generally speaking, I've never had anyone try to kill me, so I don't think that's our normal experience. But as far as our intimate friends, we should have discrimination. In fact, the whole reason why we're told these are Kanista Adhikaris, these are Madhyama Adhikaris, these are Uttama Adhikaris, these are the stages of devotion. The whole reason we're told that as far as others is to be able to judge with whom we should behave and in what way. We're supposed to uplift those who are lower than us, be friends with those who are equal, and serve those who are higher. And in order to do that, we have to have some sense of where I'm at, and we have to have some sense of where they're at. Now, we talked about this a little bit last night at the program. People can be beginning, middle, or higher in different areas differently. So some devotees are very neglectful about their japa, but they're very devoted to study of the Shastra. Some devotees are very neglectful in how they treat other devotees, but they really honor prasadam nicely. Some devotees are really into going out on Harinam and book distribution, but they're not very together about deity worship, or whatever. So some devotee may be equal to us or higher than us in one area and junior to us in another area. It's not that people are just junior to us in everything. Even, frankly, complete non-devotees are likely to be higher than us in something. Yes? Yes?
Yes.
In some knowledge or some talent or even some quality. You may meet a demon, an atheist, someone who hates God, who may be superior to you in something that you can learn from them in that something. Yes? And Prabhupada met some just ordinary man on the street when Prabhupada was distributing back to Godheads in India, who said to him, "You know, people take magazines and throw them away. Why don't you make books? People keep them." And from that chance interaction, so-called, with just some guy on the street, Prabhupada changed his whole program and he started translating the Bhagavatam. When Prabhupada was in the hospital after a stroke and the doctor came in and said, "This old man prays too much, he should get some exercise." And the devotees were horrified. And Prabhupada said, "No, he's right." And Prabhupada started going on a morning walk every day. So my point is, although Prabhupada's not going to accept these people as spiritual authorities, but in some area, Prabhupada will say, "Yes, I can hear from them." So when it comes to our spiritual life, we want to be careful about who we are intimate with, who we reveal our mind to, and who we hear revealing their mind to us. Some people, all they ever have is, you know, this authority did this thing wrong, and this authority did that thing wrong, and that devotee did that thing wrong. I mean, you know, say Hari Bo to them and give them a pakora, but don't become their intimate friend. Does that make sense? Have some discretion about who our friends are. When we have some amazing, far-out, incredible realization, we might not want to post it, you know, on Facebook or on our blog. We might want to discuss it just with people who are close to us. So again, to have some discretion, because we are influenced. We are very, 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 very small, and we're very vulnerable. We like to think we're not. We like to think that we're so powerful that we can maintain our, you know, our consciousness in any situation. Of course, the great devotees are always associating with the residents of Vrindavan internally. You know, when Prabhupada came to America alone, and he was staying with people who kept cat food, which means meat, in their refrigerator, Prabhupada wasn't intimately associating with them, because in his heart, he was always associating with the residents of Vrindavan. So the way to protect ourselves is always internally to have that high association. But even then, like Lord Chaitanya didn't want to see Mukunda. He said, "I don't want to see this Mukunda, because sometimes he's with the devotees and sometimes he's with the Mayavadis. I don't know who he is." Again, we can preach to Mayavadis. You know, Prabhupada it was interesting what kind of programs Prabhupada would preach at. Sometimes Prabhupada would preach at programs where there were many speakers and some of them were Mayavadis. And sometimes Prabhupada would say, "No, we're not going to go to that program. They simply want to use us to give authority to what they're doing." So it's a question of discretion. You know, we want to bring Krishna consciousness to the whole world, but we want to do it in a way that we don't become compromised. Like Prabhupada say, you can catch the big fish, but don't get wet. And this requires some introspection, some consultation, and some humility. I have seen over and over again people overestimate their own strength and think they can go into situations that are spiritually dangerous and come out all right, and they don't. And I've also seen people underestimate their own strength and not push themselves to preach in situations where they can actually be effective. So the main point here is to have some discretion. You know, if I want to attain Krishna prema, I want to have association with people and situations and food and circumstances that are going to help me achieve Krishna prema and not circumstances that are going to hinder me. And such is true, whatever we're doing. Prabhupada would often talk about, you know, if you want to be a stock trader, it's good to be a member of the stock exchange. You know, it's like that. I remember years ago when I was teaching at Bhaktivedanta College, so we were going to meet our accrediting institution people in the UK. So a group of us, a small group, four people, I guess, five people, we traveled from Belgium to London, and we took a train to go to the university where that was accrediting us as a bona fide institution. And we were looking for accreditation in an education degree. At that point, the college was offering a degree in theology, and we wanted to add to it an education degree. So we went to meet with the people who were the top professors in education at that university. And when we met with them, because my doctorate degree is in education, when we met with them, they were speaking the language of education professionals. Every discipline has its own language. And they can understand the concepts, the higher concepts of education. And all of a sudden I realized, I never have people I can relate with like this. I said, I don't have people in my life that I can relate with on an equal level in my own field, in my own profession, who would understand what I'm talking about. And they would, you know, they would understand me and I would understand them. And it was just like this, it was so exciting to have people that I could actually discuss my field with. And the same thing is true in our spiritual life. You know, we want to be with people that we can really relate with, that we can really have a rapport with, where we nourish them and they nourish us. And this sangha with devotees, in one sense, is everything. We can say the holy name is everything. We can say the Bhagavatam is everything. We can say the mercy of the guru is everything. And we can also say our association with the devotees is everything. So what devotees we associate with intimately, how we associate with them, how we nourish our spiritual life. And as I go on in my years in ISKCON, I'm seeing this more and more and more and more. If I have the right close friends in Krishna consciousness, and they don't have to be, for me, having them in my same geographical location is impossible because I'm constantly changing my geographical location. But having even virtually, even through email, even through Skype, whatever, is enough to make a tremendous difference in my own spiritual life and my own advancement. So, sorry for the heavy points. I don't usually talk about these things. Questions, comments, chastisements, deciding never to invite Romila back to Zagreb. Oh, there we go.
Hare Krishna. So we have one kitchen here, and it's cooked everything by Brahman devotees.
Oh, very nice. Even with just corny Thai deities.
Yes.
Very nice.
Yes.
That's and exemplary.
Cheap oil.
Huh?
Cheap oil.
We use oil.
You do use cheap. But at least you have only Brahmana cooks.
Yes.
And everything's offered to the deity.
Yes.
That's very rare in ISKCON.
Except Sunday feast.
Sometimes Sunday feasts are cooked by first initiates.
Mm.
And if it is cooked by first initiates, then it's not offered to the director to the deity.
And who is it offered to? A different Krishna who eats it.
To a picture.
A picture of the deities?
Yes.
That's hysterical.
No, the picture of the guru. Because when I was cooking here before my second initiation, I was offering to my guru.
I don't know.
But if they're offering to a picture of the deities, you know that really isn't any different than offering to
the picture of the guru. Okay. Because we have guru pictures.
Guru and Shiva Prabhupada.
Yes. Guru and Shiva Prabhupada.
Well, that's very nice. You should teach the rest of ISKCON how to do this. And this is a small temple with a small crew.
And the devotee who is basically from outside, who comes to cook here very often because he's so much attracted to this service and very, very enthusiastic in the kitchen. So he is now very often offering to his guru and Shoprao, but he is also now preparing for the Brahmin initiation.
Very nice.
Because of this activity.
Very, very nice. This is wonderful news. You should write something on Dandavats as the example for the movement, because this is extremely rare.
So, just to ask a question regarding our choices, you said that we can...
No wonder all the devotees here are so happy.
Yeah. We got instruction from RGB to set the standards in the temple, and to everybody should know them, and it should be followed. So
very
everyone
nice.
Who lives here, he is getting up for Mangalam Arati, he's on the program or she, and also the base, how it's cooked, and the standards for deities, everything works.
Very nice.
But then it also agreed with Nisimha Kavachatrabhu, who told us that it should be the second initiation, and then we erased it before it was...
That's very nice. Don't see this very many places anymore. As I say, even I often have to say, did you buy this from a shop? Even sometimes at an official temple or...
We sometimes have bread also.
That you make?
Yes.
Very nice. That's very nice. So I gave this class in the right temple. Thank
so
you. Thank
heavy.
You, Krishna. It was not a heavy class. Good. Thank you, Krishna, for giving me this verse to speak about in this temple. I was scared. I'm like, because I don't even ask anymore, you know. It's just too heavy to ask. Actually, I ask sometimes, but generally I don't ask. Sometimes they tell me. They'll give me a tour, and this is the deity kitchen, this is the devotee kitchen. And I'm like, oh... Very nice. That's wonderful. Anybody else want to say anything else?
I wanted to ask.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask regarding our choices. As you said in the beginning of the class, that we can choose if we believe this, and also if we can have this type of relationship with Krishna or Varaka or so on. Is it really so that we can choose our relationship? I want to be a gopi or I want to be...
Oh, you picked up on that. I was wondering, is anybody going to notice that I said that?
Or we, on the contrary, we don't choose it, we find out what it is. So it makes me curious, because maybe I, when we become... pure souls liberated, and we go back home to God, that for example I can be for some time in Dvaraka, then in Chaitanya Lila, then I get an idea and I become something else.
I'm so glad you asked this. In this material world, we tend to think in terms of duality. And we tend to think a lot of times in terms of or. Is it this or this? Do I have a relationship with Krishna that's assigned to me, and I just have to figure out what my assignment is? Or do I get to choose it? The answer is neither in both. We're eternal. And so our choices are also eternal, but they're still our choices. That's very difficult for us to understand in a world of causality and time. Adi Purushapu was speaking about this recently in Milan, about the fall of the jiva. That we think about a cause, and we think about time. You know, at this time, on this day, I make this choice. And before that time, on that day, I didn't make that choice. And after that time, on that day, I made this choice. But we're talking about, and because I made that choice, something happened. I was the cause. Our relationship with Krishna is always our choice. Prabhupada says that very clearly. Many places. You can choose whether to love Krishna as a lover, as a friend, as a parent, according to your personal taste. At the same time, we're always told that our relationship with Krishna is revealed. And we awaken to it, that it's revived. Sometimes it says that it's bestowed by the devotee. Gopinath Acharya Prabhu of the Oxford Hindu Center gave a talk in Harvard in 2016 when I was there as to whether our swarup is inherent or bestowed. And he said, it's both. One comparison I was thinking of at the time, it's like you have the seed of a plant. You have a mango seed, you have an apple seed, you have a cherry seed. It's already a cherry, it's already an apple, it's already a mango. But if someone doesn't put any water or soil or sunlight, it doesn't manifest. So we're already who we are, but without the grace of Guru and the devotees, we don't manifest who we are. So we are always choosing our relationship with Krishna, but we always make that choice. And I don't know how to explain it any better than that. As far as can we decide to have, can we be in more relationships at once? Oh yes. Prabhupada says the liberated soul can expand. And not unlimitedly like Krishna in every atom, but and not always in the same relationship. I mean, you see, you know, Arjuna is with as Nara, who's a Brahmana, and then as Arjuna, as a Kshatriya. And we see in Krishna Leela that some of the cowherd boys are also monkeys with Ramachandra. We see this in Chaitanya Leela, that some of Chaitanya's associates, they're Brahman associates of Lord Chaitanya. There are monkeys with Ramachandra and there are cowherd boys with Krishna, yeah? We read about this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So they have three different positions. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, in his commentary in Brahma Samhita, I'm sure it's in Brahma Samhita commentary, he says that some souls are just in Gaura Leela, some are just in Krishna Leela, and some are in both. So yes, the same jiva can have different manifestations in different leelas, if that's what they want. But that want is an eternal want. It's who we are. Our personality means we have certain opinions and certain tastes. So we eternally have certain tastes. They don't have a beginning. They don't have a choice point. But we're not created either. So it's not like we're created with as something. Then that's just who we are and we just have to deal with it, whether we like it or not. It's not like that. You know, we think of it like that because that's our situation in this world. I have this particular body, and there's things about my body I really don't like. There's things about my body I really like. And there's things about my body I really don't like. As I get older, there's practically nothing that I really like anymore. But when I was younger, there were things I liked. You know, I've never liked my nose. But I just have to live with it. I never liked my hair either. I mean, I used to like the color of it when I was young. It had a really pretty color, but it was very hard to deal with. It would never stay where I put it. I remember one time saying to my husband, oh, Prabhu, my hair's a mess. He said, your hair's always a mess. I'm like, oh, man. I have this hair that just doesn't want to behave. I should probably shave it off. But my point is, we don't like what we have. And we think that it's going to be like that. You know, Krishna's going to say, okay, you're a cowherd boy. And you go, oh, no, really? Do I have to be? For all of eternity? Like, seriously? I remember our preschool, our nursery school, I think in Europe you sometimes call them kindergartens, but in America that means something different. So we would regularly do dramas of Krishna's pastimes with the little, we're talking about children aged like 2, 3, 4, 5. And we had a bunch of pieces of cloth and didi maha and jewelry and makeup, and And we would do very simple dramas where I would just say, okay, you say this and do this. We wouldn't like memorize lines. We were just doing it for ourselves in the school. We didn't perform them. So one day we were doing the kidnapping of Rukmini, and my daughter was at that point in the nursery school. So I said, you know, who wants to be Rukmini? And so I, okay, you're Rukmini. And my daughter later, when she was an adult, told me this, that she was thinking, oh, I wanted to be Rukmini. Why did she get to be Rukmini? I wanted to be Rukmini. And then when it got to, who wants to be Rukmi? She said, I misheard you. And I thought, oh, she asked about Rukmini. I guess I didn't miss my chance. I want to, okay, you're Rukmi. Rukmi? I didn't want to be Rukmi. I wanted to be Rukmini. I had this with our drama of the Ramayana, that this one devotee, Bhagavat, came up to me. And he said, our actor who plays Sita is pregnant. She has to quit. We're looking for a new Sita. Would you be willing to be Sita? So I was like, whoa, you know, what an invitation. But at that time, my husband had told me, I don't want you on stage. I don't think it's very proper. So I just said, no, my husband wouldn't let me do it. And a week later, I said to my husband, you know, guess what? They asked me if I could be Sita. And he said, what did you tell them? And I said, you don't want me to be in the theater. I had training in theater. And he just said, oh, okay. A week later, he came to me and he said, tell them you'll be in the theater. I want you to do it. I'm like, really? Are you sure? He said, yeah, I'm sure. But in those 2 weeks, they had found another Sita. What they had done is they had taken the devotee who played Shurpanakha and had her be Sita, so now they were looking for a Shurpanakha. So now when I went to Bhagavad and said, my husband will let me be in the theater, he said, great, you can be Shurpanakha. And I was like, oh, that wasn't really my intention. So we think it's going to be like that. We think, you know, oh boy, I hope I get to be one of Krishna's mothers, you know. I really hope I can be, okay. You're a Manjari Gopi. I'm a Manjari Gopi? I wanted to be one of Yasoda's helpers. Do I have to be a Manjari Gopi? I guess I'll learn to like it. It's not like that. That would be ridiculous. Frankly, even these bodies are because of our desires. I think we're afraid of that too, because I got this body due to my own desires, and once I get it, I'm like, oh. Like sometimes you place an order for something, you think you really want it, you place an order and it comes in the mail and you get it and you go, oh, why did I want this? Sometimes it's even with the big things in your life. You know, you work really hard to buy your own house and you buy your own house and you're like, oh, it's such a burden. Why did I want this? Happens all the time in relationships. That's why there's divorce. Oh my God, I wanted to be with this person. Really? So we think it's spiritually it's like that, but it's not. Our rasa with Krishna is the most perfect expression of who we are. It is the essence of our identity. Because Krishna says, whatever appears to be a value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality. Know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So our personality, that's our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, that we are eternally persons, correct? So to be a person, there's implied some relationship with something. I have an opinion about something. I like something. I don't like something. Correct? So that about something is about Krishna. My eternal personality has to do with my opinion about how to please Krishna and my taste for how I want to please Krishna. Krishna has an unlimited number of desires and unlimited ways to be pleased. And we resonate with one or two or three or of those unlimited desires, that we're like, I want to fulfill that desire. That's what I want to do. And that is our choice. But it is always our choice. And therefore, when we're conditioned, we realize what is our choice. It's not a choice you can make with your material intellect. It's not like you can just read the books and say, well, the gopis are the highest, so I think I want to be a gopi. Or in this world, you know, I've had trouble with romantic relationships, so I think I want to be a cowherd boy. It's not that kind of a choice. You know, it's not like, well, I love to take care of animals in this life, so I think I want to be a cow. You know, that it's not like that. But it's as we become purified and as the anartas become removed, we start becoming aware of our own desires in eternal service. We start becoming aware, just even materially. If children are raised nicely, which generally they're not, but if children are raised nicely, the idea is that the parents and teachers help the child to become aware of his or her own nature. That's the idea of Varna Dharma, that the adults in the child's life, they notice, oh, this child has this proclivity and this, and they help the child to realize, oh, yes, I am this or I am that, correct? That's the idea. It's not that it's imposed on them like in China. You know, well, we need more engineers, so you're an engineer. Even sometimes we do this in ISKCON. This is what we need, so that's what you do. But it's supposed to be that we notice, oh, this person has this propensity, this nature, this inclination. That's why so many people love astrology and palm reading, because someone helps them to understand who they are. Oh, I noticed, oh, yes, I am like that. Oh, well, that's quite a talent. Really? So spiritually, that's exactly what happens. By the process of Krishna consciousness, and especially by the association of advanced devotees, we start to understand what are our tastes. At first, it may be just very general. Oh, I'd like to just, you know, I know one devotee who was long, long time pujari, and one time she was serving, actually it was Gorni Thai, in one temple, and she was listening to Bhagavatam class, and the speaker was saying, you know, something about how would you like to serve Krishna, and all of a sudden she had this vision of playing ball with Krishna and Balaram. And she realized, I really want to play ball with Krishna and Balaram. And then it may become more and more specific. One may think, oh, I want to follow Subala, or I want to follow Ujjwala, or I want to follow Sridham. Or I'm one of those cowherd boys who's really quiet and just, or I'm one of those cowherd boys who's always joking with him. And those details start to manifest. And it's very much a personal choice. One experiences it as an awakening of who one is. And again, even that happens materially in terms of our varna, in terms of our service, even in this world, in this body, we go through. Isn't that a fact? That if we're fortunate, if no one's repressing us, if we don't come from a family where everybody has to be a lawyer or something, you know, certain communities in the world, everybody has to be this. Like you meet an Indian, you pretty much guarantee they're going to be in IT or they're going to be in finance, you know, they're going to be an engineer, they're going to be a doctor, that's like it. And their nature is repressed. So is that all right? Thank you so much for that. When I said that, I thought, is anybody going to notice that and ask about it? So I was very happy. Anything else? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai.